Well, when Mark first started teaching at George Fox in 1984, he came home from the fall retreat and told me that he thought that maybe we had joined a religious cult. He said at this retreat there was all this talk of the inner light and how that of Christ was in everyone, and we listen in silence and we make decisions based on consensus out of that listening. And how irrational is that as opposed to voting? It all sounded a little fishy to our conservative Baptist Plymouth Brethren ears. But what I didn't know then, and have come to deeply appreciate since, is this understanding that Quakers are contemplatives. And by nature, contemplatives just sound fishy to non-contemplatives. As a convinced Quaker, this idea of that of God in everyone has both compelled and challenged me, so I welcome the chance to explore it when Leslie laid out the options. So a setting first. When I taught Intro to Sociology, and I was unpacking the assumptions underneath two of the major theories, I was attempting to, the two theories try to explain how social fabric holds together or doesn't. So I told the story of a rabbi who had a coat that he wore with a pocket on each side. And in one pocket, he had a bag that had a little bit of gold in it. And in the other pocket, it was a bag that had a little bit of dust and ashes. And he said everyone should have two pockets so that he or she can reach into whichever one they need in the moment. And when they're feeling lowly and depressed and discouraged, they pull out the gold and remember, I am precious in God's sight. And when they're feeling high and mighty and entitled and arrogant, they pull out the bag that reminds them they are dust and ashes. So I tell my students, these are really the two explanations for these overarching theories. Are we primarily the stuff of dust? So we need our high and mightiness to be controlled by social institutions and religious traditions and norms that will keep us behaving and keep us bound to each other? Or are we primarily the stuff of gold? And we need to be released from constraints so that we can use our giftedness creatively, and we can be generous with our generativity, and we can be connected to each other in a willing interdependency. And we'd have a robust conversation as we unpacked it, and students would get on one side or the other, and we debated and explored implications. Our Quaker topic today reminds me of that conversation. What does it mean that we hold to that of God in everyone? Does it suggest we primarily think that we are the stuff of gold? I want to give a bit of a history of the term and then what it offers us, but also what it asks of us. That of God in everyone may have shown up first in a letter that George Fox wrote from prison, and it's recounted in early Quaker faith and practice. Fox, according to what I read, didn't intend for it to be a declarative doctrinal statement, but one related to how we live out our understanding of our relationship with Christ. Our lived lives were to be our message. We were to be our witness, our lives rather than our words, inspiring us to be examples everywhere that we may come to walk cheerfully over the world, answering that of God in everyone. Fox used this phrase often and versions of it. And now Quakers, that of God ends up getting used interchangeably with that of Christ, our inner light, our spiritual essence, the capacity for goodness that resides within every human, that bit of gold that we have. Thomas Kelly, when speaking of the inner light, says, deep within us all, there is an amazing inner sanctuary of the soul, a holy place, a divine center, a speaking voice to which we may continuously return. He opens a testament of devotion with those words. I am so drawn to his language. If you are too, this very little, lovely book is one that one can read and revisit often. As we've heard in prior weeks in this series, Quakers have always held that God lives, moves, and guides in immediacy, that is, without an intermediary. within the hearts of all people. And it's common for contemplatives of all sorts to focus on this direct access we all have to God's voice. What's distinctive about this for Quakers or for Fox is this emphasis on that of God recognizing and answering that of God in all else. Like all mystical contemplative traditions, Quakers lead by love. Sometimes light and love are used interchangeably. Love, contemplatives say, is another name for God. Richard Rohr talks of that too, as is grace. Recently, Rohr was writing about grace as a name for God. It's a trusting optimism that all will be well. And there's a whispering voice of Julian of Norwich here. Because that of God, love, grace, permeates all things. Rohr says that contemplatives see the truth of things in their wholeness. Contemplatives see the truth of things in their wholeness, that of God. And from that optimism emerges an understanding that God is in all hearts, manifest in all things, the ground and source of all. A couple weeks ago, Susan Ankeny brought Father Gregory Boyle as our theologian, who's another contemplative. And Susan said, Boyle believes that if we hold on to these two ideas, one being that we are unshakably good, there's no exceptions, and the other being that we belong to each other and there are no exceptions, we may be able to recapture early Christianity's sense of a community that embraces the world with a dedication to kindness as a constant and radical act of defiance. Being unshakably good was in contrast to the Massachusetts Calvinist Puritanism, illustrated by another actually lovely book, The Puritan Prayers. This is The Valley of Vision. Like this one, which begins, this is not the lovely part. O Lord, no day of my life has passed that has not proved me guilty in thy sight. Prayers have been uttered from a prayerless heart. Praise has been often praiseless sound. My best service is filthy rags. That stood in contrast to William Penn, who saw all people not as depraved sinners, but children of God in whom God delighted, with, and I quote, the seed of the Spirit within them to be drawn out and nurtured. Rufus Jones, and I love that name. I named one of my goats Rufus Jones. He lived in the late 1800s and mid-1900s. He also asserted that the Reformation of Calvin and Luther overly focused on this pessimism of the depravity of humans in need of salvation. Yes, we need salvation, but there is an optimism of our potential that is recognized as far back as Tertullian in the second and third century. Rufus Jones agreed, and this is key, that we are wrecked. But he described it more like buds that are tightly closed up against winter sleet and cold, waiting for spring and a chance to bloom. It is easy to caricature and exaggerate the difference between these two, and it can incline us to exaggerate the implications. And Mark and I were talking this out a couple weeks ago, and it's not surprising if you know Mark that when you have conversations, usually it leads to a diagram that's written on a napkin or piece of scratch paper. One exaggerated end is total depravity, and Mark and I grew up with this. We're all bad. The other exaggerated end is that of God. We're all good. Neither of these extremes is fair. The real difference is in the middle, and it does have real implications. Total depravity doesn't actually say we're as bad as we can be, but there is no part of us that is not tainted by our human brokenness. Our physical bodies, our emotions, our intellects, our intuitions. That of God doesn't actually say we're as good as we can be, but there is one part that is untainted. A trueness, an essence of the true, a goodness, a spark of God, a Lisa-ness, a joyousness. The truth of things in their wholeness. In the interstitial spaces above and beneath and beyond, there is one part that is not tainted. That difference has implications in how we think about being formed and transformed. For instance, how might we parent our children differently if we think there is no part of our children that is not tainted by sin versus there is one untainted part to nourish, to call out. There is a seed to be nurtured. If we err, and Quaker writers warned about this, and think that of God means we're so inherently good we can lift ourselves into a life of beauty and truth, we've missed a deeper Quaker note of our faith. We are wrecked in our bodies, our emotions, our reason, our intuition, but we are always good. Christ is always the initiator to our awakening, and we are the responder. That of God within is ready to reveal our darkness, knocking at the door, not barging in without invitation. What the Puritan prayers, what this book also captures, is how beautifully we need God's grace and how ready God's grace is available. We need grace to be saved from our selfish tendencies, from our pride, from our criticism, from our judgment. I can come to thee in my need and feel peace beyond understanding is a phrase that is repeated often in this book. They give permission, these prayers, they give encouragement to look at our failings that we might be transformed. A potential error of our contemporary emphasis on our goodness is minimizing, not seeing our need for, maybe not even giving ourselves permission to look deeply at our sin and our need for salvation from our false selves. While early Quakers saw our need to look at personal sin as well as collective sin, George Fox was responding to a sense that that of God was diminished in various ways that Christianity of his time focused on personal sin and on our terribleness. Fox and other Quakers encouraged Christ followers to abide with, to be attuned to that of God in them, that they might answer that of God in everyone. And how were they to do that? Early Quakers encouraged practicing habits that help them say yes to the invitations and nudges of our present teacher, to keep an orientation toward the depths, toward that of God, that we might live in gratitude, in love, in awareness of Christ speaking to us, breathing with us as we live our ordinary lives. This is not about living a discipled, disciplined life that we may achieve spiritual maturity, but it's about hanging out with, being attuned to that of God within, that one relationship, coined by Julian, we might be transformed. Thomas Kelly talks about ordering our mental life on two levels at once. One is checking in on the children, answering the email, prepping for class. The other is humming along with a prayer, a song, being gently receptive to that of God we encounter in every moment, in all people, in all things. I'm responding to every moment in one way or another. Too often, I'm responding to a moment in judgment, in cynicism, in despair. I want to practice at responding instead with awe and curiosity and gratitude, looking for the truth of things in their wholeness, for that of God in the moment. How do we practice attending to this deeper level? Carolyn Stephen, who is a 19th century convinced friend, an author of Quaker Strongholds, outlined the principles of the Society of Friends, and the cornerstone is, she says, that of God in everyone, that God communicates with each spirit God made. And to hear God's divine voice, we need to be still. We need to be alone with God in silence. She says, one finds their first repose, then an awful guidance, a light which burns and purifies. This guidance is away from self-indulgence, often away from outward success, often through humiliation and failure, through snares and temptations. Yes, yes, God looks on us with delight. And yes, yes, God calls us into an examined, attuned life, one with still, silent waiting that we might learn to recognize the guiding, sometimes piercingly so, voice of Christ. There's a humility in coming together to worship in silence. Words are not necessary. Words are distracting. They get in the way. We use caution before we speak. Where that of God in me is seeking that of God in you. an invitation to self? Am I putting myself in postures of attunement to God that I might learn to listen to the always present piercing voice of love? This outward implication that of God suggests all people have a natural soundness, a seed of Christ sleeping, waiting to be awakened, and that it's recognizable. This is a sticking point for me. What does it mean to see that of God in people who live so counter to how I feel called to live? The best I can imagine is that the seed of Christ is sleeping, waiting to be awakened. Can I really believe it's present enough or recognizable enough that God in me might answer that of God in them? When talking of Gregory Boyle, Susan said he believed that the answer to every question was compassion, not an everyone lives happily ever after naivete, but one of love and commitment that stays strong through horrible stories and circumstances. Is it really as simple as asking? Susan was challenging us with this, as Boyle does. Does a healthy, whole, well person ever? I don't know, but it causes me to wonder what changes in that deeper level that Thomas Kelly talks about when my posture is for that of God in me to see that of God in you, whoever you are. To be dedicated to kindness as a constant and radical act of defiance, even if I think you're wreaking havoc on the world. What changes if I lean into this Quaker value that there is a spark that is unchangeably good in everyone? I have been stymied on this point and had this on my mind at a family dinner a couple of weeks ago. My son-in-law asked how we were feeling about driving a Tesla these days, and just the day before, someone else had said, "Are you going to sell your Tesla?" So I've been thinking about what is my radical act of defiance? What should that look like? I am ambivalent about driving a Tesla right now, and we could sell it, but I wonder if to do so would be making a decision about what I'm against more than what I'm for. There is a time for both, of course, but it seems just now it may be more important to consider what I'm for and to lean into where that leads. And maybe that's answering that of God around me. Then I thought of us. In the same way that Melanie did a couple weeks ago, we lean into what we're for when we stand in front of Iglesia Los Amigos each Sunday. We lean into what we're for when we show up and buy tamales. We lean into what we're for when through the Peace Trail Village we find ways to support houselessness in Newburgh rather than simply fighting the city. It feels like we're accepting George Fox's admonition for our lives to be our message. That we can with confidence walk cheerfully over the world answering that of God in everyone. The word cheerfully got my attention. It seems oddly placed in that sentence until Melanie offered a reminder by George Fox to remember that the seed of Christ is over all and reigns. And this is that same quote. "Sing and rejoice, ye children of the day and of the light, for the Lord is at work in this thick night of darkness that may be felt. And truth doth flourish as the rose, and the lilies do grow among the thorns." Wow, it's happening to me too. "And the plants atop the hills, and upon them the lambs and baby goats do skip and play. And never heed the tempest, nor the storms, floods, nor rains, for the seed, Christ, is over all and doth reign." If George Fox believed that, and Julian of Norwich, and Gregory Boyle, and so many other contemplatives who see that of God in all things, can I believe it? Can you? Can we? One final implication. This is so weird. Melanie, where are you? Most contemplative traditions affirm that of God extends beyond humans. And I love that John Woolman does this. He said that justice and goodness should extend to the brute creatures, to all God's manifestations in the visible world. God's breath of life is kindled in all animals. And if we say we love God yet are cruel toward the least creature, Woolman says we are living a contradiction. Hildegard of Bingen, Bonaventure, Francis of Assisi, these are contemplatives that predate Quakers. 19th century Pierre Teilhard, they're just a few that affirm this. Hildegard says, and she's speaking of God, "I burn in the sun and the moon and the stars. The secret life of me breathes in the wind and holds all things together soulfully. All matter, say these contemplatives, are manifestations of that of God in all things. All things are sacred. All things are holy. Everything, everything. It's a point Leslie made last week, and the point of that song I wanted to sing again. Oceans and mountains, the earth itself. That of God is a hope-filled claim, recognizing God's active presence in all things, though it is a hope in the long game. I will not see that resolution in my lifetime. It seems I have somewhat of a choice, not one easily lived out. I can live my life in righteous anger and spend words and energy defining what I'm against. I can live it in despair and give up. Or I can answer that of God in all things. I can practice answering that of God in all things and live out of a hope in a truth that inclines me to ask, how can I love, show compassion, live for life, recognizing that all I encounter carries seeds of Christ, carry that of God.